When a crime affects you, especially when it takes the life of a loved one, the pain doesn't go away.
It's been 12 and a half years for anyone else, but for me and my family, it's still yesterday. You know, we're still stuck in that moment.
Birmingham's homicide rate rose in 2015, but those aren't the only crimes people are talking about.
Our crime is mostly car thefts and property being stolen.
This afternoon, a conversation about crime around Birmingham on Issues and Ails. I'm Andrew Yeager. We'll talk about what the numbers tell us, what contributes to crime, and how we can prevent it.
The solutions are not new, because the problems are not new.
Stay with us for Issues and Ails, crime in the greater Birmingham area, on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. You're listening to Issues and Ails on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. I'm Andrew Yeager. The first Sunday of March was a bloody one in Birmingham. In a single day, three people were shot and killed in separate incidents in different parts of the city. 2015 saw Birmingham's homicide rate rise, nowhere near historic highs, but it does reverse the downward trajectory of the previous few years. Those murders, along with chatter of car break-ins, burglaries, it makes you wonder if perhaps something is changing in our communities, and not in a good way. We'll talk about crime around the Birmingham area, what we know about it, what seems to be happening at this moment, and later on we'll look at some responses from the law enforcement community and others. Throughout, we'll hear questions and insights from the audience. So, let's get to our first panel. I'm joined by Jeffrey Walker. He's chair of the Justice Sciences Department at UAB. For 25 years, he's written and studied how crime relates to neighborhood change. Also, Waladine Streeter, who's president of the Bush Hills Neighborhood Association. She's currently president of the Western Area Block Association as well. Also joined by Captain Scott Prater. He's a 25-year veteran of the Birmingham Police Department, much of that time as an investigator. And Carmone Owens, owner of Exotic Upholstery in Birmingham. He served 8 years after being convicted on 8 counts of armed robbery, and we thank them very much for joining us. Captain Prater, I'd like to start with you, because we see this headline number. We see a rise in murder rates, but of course, crime is more than just murder. There are other crimes as well. So as you think about the last year from a big picture perspective, can we say crime has gone up over the last year?
Not in Birmingham. The perception was that it went up. When the final numbers are tallied, we'll actually probably be down about 3% from the previous year. We have to understand that with social media and the all the TV channels and radio stations out there, news gets to you faster, you see more. And when you look at a homicide, you can, just taking that homicide for example, you can bet it's going to be on the air at least 4 times. When it happens, then there's going to be an update, then there's going to be some sort of comment from the family members, and then it's going to air when someone's charged and put in jail. So you're seeing this on the news spread out, and a lot of people think, well, wow, there's another homicide in the city of Birmingham, and it's not like that. While we were up in homicides last year from the previous year, that previous year was an anomaly for the city. It was our lowest rate in over 50 years of stats in the city. So our numbers, while much higher than we would like them to be at 78, were still low compared to where we were at in the 90s. We've steadily had a decline in the 2000s, and we're proud of that, and we're working hard to keep doing that.
We'll talk a little more about perception later on, but Waladine Streeter, I'm curious for you at the neighborhood level in your community in Bush Hills, what do you hear from residents? What do you hear from people around this issue of crime?
Well, we're very concerned about the crime in our neighborhoods. We are, with our police officers, making contact, close relationship with our officers in the West Precinct, making sure that they patrol our area more. And we try to contact them when we see strange activities in our neighborhood so that they can jump on it before serious situations occur in the neighborhood. But in the Bush Hill neighborhood, our crime is mostly concerning car thefts and property being stolen. That's most of what we have in the Bush Hill neighborhood.
Well, Jeffrey Walker, could you put this into some context for us? Because we have that murder rate that gets all the attention. We have this play between perception and the actual crime rate. I guess put this into a little bit of perspective. How do we deal with that gap?
Right, and you have to appreciate that murder rates, as Ken Prater said, are a lot of it is perception. Violent crime across the nation is down. We're near historic lows, so when you do have these bump ups, it seems like a lot. And of course, you know, any murder is too many, but we're still pretty low. And it's hard to predict. You're going to have these fluctuations. It's important for neighborhoods to be involved. It's important for the police to work with the neighborhoods carefully. And a lot of times it's the empowerment of the neighborhoods that really kind of makes a difference in crime rates and the amount of crime that happens. So the perspective here, and I just got to Birmingham in July coming from Little Rock, and it's very similar. You see the same kind of rises and decreases. The police agencies are both very, very, very strong and close to the community, and that's a good thing. So I was very happy to move here. I'm not worried about the crime rate all that much.
Well, I want to bring Carmona Owens into this because you have been perhaps in a little different relationship to this issue than the others on this panel. Just give me a little bit of your story and your background and sort of what led to serving 8 years for armed robbery.
Well, before going into that, let me go into some a shift away from perspective, because the perspective of the crime is up. One of the issues at hand is that more people enter the Department of Correctional System from Jefferson County than any other county in the state. Therefore, you have more people returning from the Department of Correctional System to Jefferson County than anywhere else in the state. And when you want to impact the numbers of recidivism, which you have a lot of repeat offenders committing crimes upon release, and one of the ways to impact that is having programs upon their release to give them goals, give them structure, get them employed. So there's a lot of things that can be impacted on the ground floor level that can impact crime and the perception of crime and repeat offenders. Now, going into myself, I'm from Detroit, and I had a bad divorce. And I'm not making excuses, but in the course of that, when I moved down here, my child support was exceedingly high, more than my gross paycheck, because I made very good money when I was there. Now, many people who enter the correctional system use drugs at the time of the crime that was committed, be it alcohol or drugs. There's an underlying common thread of some type of system substance abuse or substance usage, which was the case in my case. I rationalized the irrational, did something no one thought I would do, and I stole money that I actually could have borrowed with two phone calls. The person who helped me get out of jail is the person who sent me to jail, my judge. He was very instrumental in my being released. While incarcerated, I attained my associate's in theology, my bachelor of biblical studies, my master of biblical studies, realizing that the career I had before I couldn't have now because I had a felony on me, I went to trade school at J.F. Ingram Technical College and learned upholstery. So the entrepreneurial side of me was able to market the trade, and now I'm being an entrepreneur, a capital business owner. So I understand both sides of the equation because I'm in the Eastlake community, property crime, armed robbery, such things, Woodlawn, Eastlake, you know the history of those communities there. So I understand both sides of the equation. But one way to actually impact the crime problem is you've got to deal with people who are repeat offenders.
You're listening to Issues and Ails, Crime in the Greater Birmingham Area on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. We're speaking with Captain Scott Prater of the Birmingham Police Department, also Waladine Streeter, President of the Bush Hills Neighborhood Association, Jeffrey Walker, Chair of the Justice Sciences Department at UAB, and Carmen Owens, owner of Exotic Upholstery in Birmingham. And Captain Prater, I'll return to you because we have this split. We have the split between this headline-grabbing murder rate, and then other crimes, property crimes, that are down year on year. What are the causes, or what do you think the causes are, to see that homicide rate jump while other crimes don't seem to be?
You know, a lot of factors go into it. You've got drugs, socioeconomic factors figure in. You know, people in densely populated areas that they see no way out of, that 1 second that they should have taken to resolve it a different way, it turns to violence. And you see, if a lot of homicides happen, and you think if you had just taken 10 seconds, just 10 seconds to think about what you were about to do, you wouldn't have cost someone their life, ruined your family's life, ruined the victim's life. When we talk to offenders, oftentimes they say that, had I just turned around and got in my car like I started to do, I wouldn't be here right now, and everybody's life affected. There's a lot of factors. I wish I could tell you what makes it happen. I would have a lot of money and wouldn't be sitting in this room today if I could, because I think we're all searching for that answer.
Jeffrey Walker, I saw you shaking your head there during that response, especially about the impulsive nature of these sorts of crimes.
Aggravated assault, assault in general, murder particularly, a lot of times it's a crime of the moment. It may be because of drug use, it may be because of alcohol use, it may be because of fights and those kinds of things. There's also, it seems to be more recently, a little bit of what I call a permission for violence. There's a lot of violence that you see in TV, and I'm not talking about learning from video games and that kind of thing, but you see the Ferguson issues, you see war issues, you see all of this kind of stuff, and there's almost a permission of violence for people that may be factoring into this across the board. Now, it's not spiking violence, but it seems to be a little bit of perception of people that it's kind of okay to do that. And they may get into this impulse mode, especially if there's some alcohol or drugs involved, where they reach for a gun or reach for a knife or something like that in this crime of the moment.
Waldine Streeter, I'm curious to hear from you, because as I've had conversations around this issue with people on the west side of Birmingham, also in the suburbs, one thing that I've heard is, well, it's outsiders. It's not people in our community. It's not people we know that are doing these things. What's your sense?
I feel that we're having problems with property, our children, the parents. We have single parents. They're working many jobs. They do not have the parents there to protect them, teach them. We also involved in drugs. We have plenty of drugs in the communities. We do not have good education programs. Our children, we're not having training. When they finish high school, they do not know where they're going. They have no idea what this workforce is about. So they're looking for a quick way to make money and to live the lifestyle that they want to live, and they want it quick. So I'm not going to say it's not happening with the people in our community. It has to be some of the people in your community that's doing these crimes. But we as people, we as leaders, government, we need to come together and think about the community and what the community needs, what the children need. They need a good education. So we need to stop trying to say it's not happening in our neighborhoods, because it's happening all over the United States in all neighborhoods, suburbs, rich, middle class, which we hardly have middle class anymore, but it is happening. So we need to face it as people and stop denying what is really happening in our world. And we need to make the government accountable for what. We can't hire school teachers. We can't pay school teachers, but who pay them? Our taxes pay them. So why can't we ask and speak up for what we really want and what we need as people and stop letting them tear us down? Because it's the government. It's the leaders that's tearing us down.
Question here from the audience for Dr. Walker. You mentioned empowerment of the neighborhoods. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that happens a lot of times, we get into these situations where we think we've got high crime or whatever, and invariably somebody says, well, this is a police problem. It's not a police problem. They're the ones who chase the horse that's already left the barn. And that's their responsibility, and they do all of that kind of stuff. But if we're going to change what we're doing in terms of crime, we've got to go back much, 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 much further than that. We've got to get into the neighborhoods themselves and start with the children and say, okay, we've got to change how you're doing. You've got to give them an outlook. a lot of the very structurally disadvantaged neighborhoods, the children don't have, they don't perceive a future. You go into the schools in these poor neighborhoods a lot of times and you say, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you don't get a lot of, I want to be an accountant, I want to be an engineer, I want to be a computer person, because they don't perceive that. One of the most tragic things, I lived in Texas for a while, and a news reporter went into a school and was asking the children, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, different things. And they asked this one young man, what do you want to be when you grow up? He's about six. And he said, well, I want to be an inmate in the Texas Department of Corrections. And they were very confused. And they said, well, why do you say that? So, well, my dad's in Texas Department of Corrections. My brother's in Texas Department of Corrections. My uncle's in the Texas Department of Corrections. And that's what he knew, is I'm going to grow up, and through the environment or myself or the drugs or whatever it is, I'm going to wind up in Texas Department of Corrections. And we've got to change that at the neighborhood level. We've got to have that empowerment at the neighborhood level to let the neighborhood and the people of the neighborhoods understand that there is a future and there's a better way. The trade craft is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things that let people understand that they can change the way they do things.
Question here. I believe this would be directed to Captain Prater. So we've talked about homicides, of course. What about theft and break-ins? This person lives in Birmingham and says it feels like we have a theft or break-in every day the past few months. How do you address that?
Yeah, when it affects your neighborhood, it does seem like you have them every day. You know, for the past several years, our break-ins have gone down. Now, the thefts are trending up a little bit right now, been down the past few years, but let me explain to you, when we talk about the community being able to help itself and help us, this is the thing that we spoke of at our CompStat meeting this morning with the chief. A lot of car break-ins. When we talk to the people, well, my purse was laying on the front seat, somebody broke in and got it. I left my laptop laying in the back seat, somebody got it. We're talking about those kind of thefts. Vehicle thefts right now are up a little bit. Most of our vehicle thefts are cars where the keys are left in the vehicle. Cars are harder to steal now than they used to be. You used to get in there and break the steering column, take off in the car. You can't do that anymore. But when the keys are in the ignition, it's easy to jump in and drive off. And you say, well, why do people leave keys in the ignition? When it's cold outside, they warm their cars before they get in them in the morning. Car takes off without them. People notoriously bad at pulling up to convenience stores in the middle of the night, jumping out to run and grab a Coke and leaving their car running. Your car's not going to get cold for the 3 minutes that you're inside there getting that drink. And frighteningly, many of those people leave their children strapped in the back in a car seat, and those stolen cars are dumped somewhere down the road once they realize they have a child in the back seat. Those kind of things we've been trying to make the public aware of to help us with. That's so when you hear about a lot of car break-ins, what they're doing now, one thing they're doing is just lifting the door handles. They're not even breaking the glass. They're lifting the door handles, and people are leaving their doors unlocked with stuff in their cars, visible. So we have to get that message out to help us with that. Let's put the things undercover. Let's put them in the trunk. Let's lock our cars. It'll help. But as far as the numbers, I'm sure, you know, when a community's hit and they find out that, you know, four or five cars were broken into down the street, of course, people live in that community, it seems like it's going to be up. But the numbers overall, they are down.
It's a proven fact. Criminals do not like light. Criminals do not like nosy neighbors. And we need to be more involved in what a community actually is, because in a community, you can't call yourself community and you don't know who lives three doors down from you. You don't know who lives across the street. And we've really gotten into so deeply into being online and being disconnected from neighbors, disconnected from the old-fashioned associations. Now, Jesus taught, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, and soul. But the second commandment, which he said is equal to the first, is loving your neighbor. And where I live in East Lake, I'm very fortunate to have good neighbors. That's one of the reasons I moved into that house, is because I have an excellent neighbor who's been there a long time on one side of me and another excellent neighbor on the other side of me, and we watch out for each other. And when you have blocks that do that, criminals immediately pick up on that when you have the old-fashioned neighborhood watch, not the sign, but people visibly watching out for each other. And criminals, they watch these things, soft targets. So if we become more of an actual community and we become neighbors again, the solutions are not new, because the problems are not new. But we've stopped using the solutions that we used to use before. Many of us, when we grew up, you knew almost everybody on your block. But nowadays, we don't know who lives four doors down.
That's Carmen Owens, owner of Exotic Upholstery in Birmingham. We're also speaking with Jeffrey Walker, chair of the Justice Sciences Department at UAB. Waldron Streeter, president of the Bush Hills Neighborhood Association, and Captain Scott Prater of the Birmingham Police Department. You are listening to Issues and Ails, Crime in the Greater Birmingham Area. I'm Andrew Yeager. I've had a couple of questions from the audience about gun control, and perhaps this is best for Captain Prater or Dr. Walker. What's your opinion of concealed carry on college campuses and public places? Do they prevent crime? Does it deter crime? What do we know about policies like that?
Well, that's, you know, that's a tricky one there. College campuses, and I'm for gun rights. I think people should be able to carry concealed weapons. Now, private property, I think property owners have the right to determine who should be able to carry and not carry into the event. You don't want an event like, we've got basketball going on right now at the Civic Center. You don't want a bunch of people in there with guns. It's an emotional event. Argument starts. What happens? Somebody gets shot. Or gun falls out of somebody's pocket and shoots somebody. No place for it. You got police taking care of the event, no need. So I think private businesses should be able to direct who can and cannot carry. I think the same thing with campuses. I think if we feel the need that people should be able to carry guns on college campuses, maybe we need to look at putting more money into security on those college campuses. I just think that's another thing that not only the students have to deal with, but law enforcement has to deal with as well. I think in everyday life, of course, carry a concealed weapon is your right to do. I just think in certain places, maybe not such a good idea.
Well, as we come to the close of this portion of the program, one of the themes throughout this discussion seems to be people think there's crime. And we've documented that there has been a rise of homicide in Birmingham, but Captain Prater, you said that that's not the case all over. Crime is down. So how do you operate within this world where perception is so strong? I've had a break-in in my neighborhood. Crime is going up.
One thing you can't measure is how many things you prevented, because you don't know if you prevented them. We hope that we are. The thing that we're trying to get out there, long before Ferguson, we saw that we couldn't arrest our way out of the problems that we have. Putting more people in jail is not the answer. We have learned that that was a mistake, that we have to look at the population in the city of Birmingham, probably 2% or less are the ones out there driving the violent crime in the city. Those are the ones we have to identify, we have to go after. We have to do it with the help of the communities. Because you have to remember, we're taking men and women in their 20s. We're putting them out on the street with the best law enforcement training you can get. They're called to handle everyone's problems that they can't handle, whether it be my 14-year-old son that I can't make mine, to the tree limb that fell on my car. City of Birmingham answers an average of 5,000 calls for service per week. That's a lot of calls. Many of those calls are, I heard a bump in the backyard, cat ran out of the house, I can't find it. Those are true things. We've been called to get ghosts out of people's houses. You get those calls. We have to have better communication. We have to have the community understand that we're humans too. And when an officer does something, don't label us all, just like we shouldn't label everybody in the community. When you get in the city of Birmingham, and this lady's community I know very well, you get in the community, when we're talking about 2% of the population driving the violent crime in the city of Birmingham, Unfortunately, that 2% is what we deal with most of the time, because they're the ones we've been called on, or they brought us to them for some reason. So it tends to make you a little hard. And sometimes just a simple icebreaker will take that away, and you'll be surprised what you'll find out. So it goes both ways. We need to learn to talk to one another again and to communicate. And in this age, it's hard to do with all the social media, to learn to actually look somebody in the eye and talk to them again, whether you agree with them or disagree with them, to be able to have a conversation. I think we've forgotten how to do it, and we've got to get back to being able to do that.
Well, that brings the first half of this program to a close. I'd like to thank our panelists, Captain Scott Prater of the Birmingham Police Department, Waladine Streeter, President of the Bush Hills Neighborhood Association, Jeffrey Walker, Chair of the Justice Sciences Department at UAB, and Carmone Owens, owner of Exotic Upholstery in Birmingham. Stay with us. After a short break, we'll be joined by WBHM News Director Rachel Lindley, and we'll discuss how police and communities can respond to and prevent crime. This is Issues and Ails, Crime in the Greater Birmingham Area, on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN.
Welcome back. This is Issues and Ails, Crime in the Greater Birmingham Area, on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. I'm Rachel Lindley. If you're just joining me, our first panel described the state of criminal activity in our region. Birmingham finished last year with its highest number of homicides in years, and stories of robberies and car thefts are more and more common on social media and on the nightly news. Now, we move our conversation to solutions and hear from law enforcement and citizens about what can be done to make our cities safer. Throughout the conversation, we'll also hear questions and comments from the audience. I'm joined now by Dr. Geralyn Agee. She's the manager of the newly formed Birmingham Violence Reduction Initiative. She works with Birmingham's Police Department, the Jefferson County DA, the U.S. Attorney, and the Community Foundation, and local faith and community-based groups to keep Birmingham residents safe, alive, and out of prison. Dr. Amy Atkin. She's the executive director of Better Basics. The group advances literacy through enrichment and intervention programs. Dr. Aiken has taught special needs high school and elementary students and managed at the school and district levels. Sergeant John Pennington has over 20 years of experience with the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. He's currently a spokesperson for their public outreach initiatives, including Neighborhood Watch. Sergeant Pennington is also a coordinator at Crime Stoppers of Metro Alabama, a program that offers cash rewards for tips that lead to arrests of felony offenders. And Carolyn Johnson Turner, the founder of Parents Against Violence Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization committed to educating youth about the consequences of using violence. In 2003, her oldest son was shot and killed by a stray bullet. Since the death of her son, she's worked as an activist for safer communities and a victim's advocate. To start, I want to ask a panel a question to the entire panel. This is something that came up during when we were getting our audience questions from the last panel. What will it take to change that mindset of people that they just don't want to get involved? And what will help make them feel more comfortable in being active in this process?
First and foremost, the belief that, you know, if I take that first step forward, if I take the risk, the potential risk, that something will be done and something productive will come out of that effort.
I think sometimes people don't want to get involved because they are fearful of maybe retaliation from the person that committed a crime or what have you, and sometimes they just don't know what to do. You know, they don't want to get hurt or, you know, bring, I guess, more harm to them, but not understanding that, you know, if you don't get involved, you could be the next victim. I can say that because we have a campaign that we're doing, and it's called Who Killed My Child, and also the It Ain't Snitching If It Happens to You campaign. And we named it It Ain't Snitching If It Happens to You because we keep hearing in the community that people are saying, well, don't snitch, don't tell, You know, if you see someone's house being broken into, or a car being stolen, or someone being killed, like my son, it's like, don't tell, don't say anything, don't snitch. We started the campaign to get people involved and to make them feel safe and coming forward, giving information to the police department. And also, I think if we can build a better morale with the police department and making, you know, the citizens feel that they can trust the police, that, you know, they're not going to tell the criminal that they were the ones that submitted the information to the police department or what have you. So I think if we do things like that, just reassure them that they will be safe, it would probably get them to talking more, at least.
I think that having more positive relationships with between the community and the police as part of the community would help people to feel more confident in being able to share information. One thing that I recognize, even in my own life, there's a tale of two cities here in the Birmingham area. I live over the mountain, but on any given day, I can be with Captain Prater, and we visited last week. We were in New Hill, and we were in other points west where there's a lot of things that go on, and people don't talk. And we met with a mother at that time whose home had just been burglarized, and I gave her my number to call me, but I was concerned about if she would call me for any kind of help or support for herself or her son because of how afraid she was of the situation that she was in, even being afraid that we were actually there to provide her support and help. But where I live, over the mountain, you know, we had a situation where my side door of my house was unlocked, and a friend of mine, a neighbor, called and said that the side door was unlocked. The sheriff went in, petted the dog, called me, said the house was secure, and locked the door for me, you know, and I felt good about being able to call the sheriff and get that done. But I think it has to have these more interactions where people feel confident that if I call, these are the things that are going to be shared or not shared. I'm still going to be safe, and I'll be able to, you know, live in my community without fear. But I think it takes a lot of relationship building and people actually, like he said, taking that risk, but actually taking the risk away.
Dr. Aiken, do you have anything to add?
I would just add that it's about talking to our children. It's about talking to each other, and it's about building relationships. I was in an elementary school recently, and the children were sharing about race issues in their community. And one of the things that the children were sharing is that they were afraid of the police. And at the end of the discussion, I said, "Have you had interactions with the police officers in your neighborhood?" And the child said, "No, ma'am, I haven't." And I said, "Well, then why are you afraid of the police?" And they said, "Because I see things on the news." And my advice to the young man was, the next time you see the police in your neighborhood, you need to wave and you need to smile and you need to say hello, because the police will reach back. It's about community building relationships, and it's about parents talking to their children, and it's about parents saying, there's no reason to be afraid, and the police are here to help us, and the neighbors are here to help us, and we're all here to help one another. So the children are taking on things that they hear in the home, and they're bringing it to school, and they're talking about it. So it's all of us talking to each other. It's having those conversations.
Dr. Agee, now that we're moving to the conversation where we're talking about solutions, one of the things that we have to talk about is Birmingham's new violence reduction initiative that you are the head of. So can you just explain to some of us that might not have heard about it what the initiative is, how it works, and what your role in it is?
So I'm the manager of the Violence Reduction Initiative, and what that means is I manage the three components of the initiative, which includes a support and outreach, and that's where we find and provide resources for the mostly men that we meet who find themselves vulnerable for being the city's next homicide suspect or victim. I work with the community on what we call moral voice and engagement, and that's where we look at a vision of peace for the city. And I just met with a group of ministers who are going to be providing support and helping us with things that we do with the initiative, including custom notifications. And then I work alongside with Captain Prater in his unit in something that's called law enforcement. And under that is where we look at the people who are involved in shootings and homicides, and we bring them in for something called a call-in, where we give them notice that, hey, we know that you're vulnerable. We know that these are the people that you're involved with in your life, and we're concerned about you. We want you safe, alive, and out of prison. And that message comes from me as a civilian, as a mother of two young sons. But when we're sitting in the call-in, they don't just hear that message from me. They hear it from Mayor Bell. They hear it from the district attorney, Brandon Falls. He's here in the audience. They hear it from the U.S. attorney, Joyce White Vance, who's very integral as part of this violence reduction initiative. And then they also hear a message from the chief of police, as well as Captain Prater, and then members of the community. And the members of the community represent different voices that that have to do with the impact of homicide in our community. So Carolyn Johnson Turner, she's spoken before at the call-ins and talked about her life and her experiences, and that's probably the most compelling and moving part of our call-in for us to see what is the reality of what's going on in our community. And we also hear from the faith-based community and then someone who's been formerly incarcerated. And the goal of the call-in, the goal of the violence reduction initiative is to actually lessen incarceration, to actually strengthen our community and improve our relationships. And I can say, having this job for a year, I've seen it with my own eyes, the opportunities that we've had to build community and to be more accurate and know more about what's going on in our communities with the shootings and homicides. Because I've had jobs before where I've had a lot of federal grant money, millions of dollars, and great intentions, but with the lack of strategy, then we still see people falling into the same traps. And so I feel really good about being involved with the VRI and being able to find actual strategies and ways that we can save our sons. It's what I talk about, because that's what where I come from. But each one of the partners with this looks at it from a different lens, and we all want the same thing, which is to see less people die in the streets.
And Dr. Agee, you mentioned that Carolyn Johnson-Turner has come to these call-ins with the young men and shared her story, and that it's often one of the most powerful parts of that call-in. Carolyn, I just want to bring you into the conversation. If you could share with us your own story.
Yes, my son was, he was 20 years old. His name was Rodriguez. He left home going to a birthday party on November 22nd, 2003. When he got to the birthday party, apparently some guys had already got into an altercation out there, and I'm told that they were going to the car to get guns, or they had already gotten guns or whatever. And by the time that Rodriguez was parking his car, these guys start shooting, and one of the bullets went through the windshield of his vehicle and struck him in his head and killed him. And it's just a devastating experience to have to go through that, you know, to see your healthy, happy, lively child leave out of the door and say he's going to a birthday party and say he'll be back, and he doesn't come back home. You know, that's really hard to grasp as a parent. It's been 12 and a half years for anyone else, but for me and my family, it's still yesterday. You know, we're still stuck in that moment. So that's why I started Parents Against Violence, and that's why I'm fighting every day, not only for justice for Rodriguez, because there were a lot of people out there when he got killed, but no one has come forward to say who was shooting out there. And back to the getting involved part, you know, I'm feeling the effect of that too, you know, with people not wanting to get involved, because several people know who shot him, but no one will say anything. What keeps me going is being able to make a difference in the lives of so many other young people, and to be able to help parents in a position like myself, because I didn't know what to do when my child was murdered. But thank God I had a lot of people around me, a lot of supporters who just wouldn't let me fall. You know, they kept me going. And I told God, I said, well, if you let me live, I have to do something to save these kids. And that's what I've been doing for the last going on 13 years now.
There is so much that has been said about how important it is that families are involved with their children when it comes to preventing crime. You know, it also just seems like if a parent's not involved, they're not involved in their children's life. Is there anything that can actually be done to change that?
I've heard that before, that families aren't involved, or parents don't know what their kids are doing. Actually going out with the chief, going out with Captain Prater, and knocking on people's doors and actually talking to moms, we've met a lot of mothers that have been trying, that have been looking for, you know, a way out for themselves or their sons. And so there is so much going on in the community that has a greater influence or impact on these young people than the parents, that we can't just say that these are just absent parents or parents that don't care. One of the places that we went to, there was a young man who he left, obviously, I think he saw us coming up, and maybe he went out the back door, and both his parents just kept calling his cell phone over and over and over again, telling him to come back home because the chief of police was there looking for him. He wasn't under arrest. But the young man didn't come back till his brother called his phone and said, come back in the house. And then the young man we were looking for came in. And what we're finding is that the influence shifts at such a young age. For most of us, our parents still had an influence on us when we went to high school or college or even yet today. But in some of these environments, the influence shifts from the parents to an older brother or an older cousin or someone that's just maybe 4 or 5 years older than them. And that shift in influence has a big impact on the decisions that they make and the things that they're doing in the streets. So I think that a really concerted effort needs to happen to get parents more support for how to deal with this, because, you know, some of them are getting greater influence from the streets on their children than the parents have.
Dr. Aiken, can you speak to parental involvement? I know you work with much younger children.
Yes, I would say that parents are not absent. Parents are overwhelmed. And anybody in this room who's a parent would probably agree with me. If you're a parent, you're overwhelmed in the 21st century. There are so many things vying for our attention. And then the children who are living in these high crime, high poverty areas have so many other things to deal with. The parents in these communities have so many other things to deal with, on top of the many stresses that we're all dealing with as parents. So I would argue that they don't mean to be absent. They don't want to be absent. They're not really absent. They are completely and totally overwhelmed, and they need support. They don't know how to help their children in school. They don't know how to keep their children off the streets. These are major problems that there's not for lack of a better word, there's not a magic bullet or magic potion or anything to fix this issue. This is a community effort. This is about all of us coming together to fix these issues.
You're listening to Issues and Ails on 90.3 WBHM Birmingham and 91.5 WSGN Gadsden. I'm Rachel Lindley. We're speaking with Dr. Amy Aiken, Dr. Geralyn Agee, Sergeant John Pennington of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, and Carolyn Johnson Turner, the founder of Parents Against Violence. This next question is for Sergeant Pennington. You work with Neighborhood Watch, and you recently joined the community-based messaging site Nextdoor to interact more with the community. What is it that you and your fellow law enforcement officers need from the community? What makes for a successful citizen and law enforcement cooperation?
I would say the dialogue has to be two-way. It has to be consistent, and it has to be frank. That's one area that sometimes is a little bit difficult. If it impacts my community, it may be different depending on what side of town we're talking about. If we're talking about it in an urban area, lower income, you know, there's pretty much frank, open honesty about what's going on there. If it's going on over the mountain, maybe not so much. But I think we're coming around on that one, and I think that through the social media sites such as Nextdoor, which we plan on using quite a lot with the Sheriff's Office, I think Hoover PD is already using that. You know, we can provide that conduit for that communication back and forth. Whenever you do that, you run the risk of a glut of information and feedback, but it's much preferable to have that than it is nothing at all. And of course, there's been many Neighborhood Watch associations that have used Facebook and have for quite a while. Sometimes the problem with Facebook is it's a little bit of everything, and its reach is so wide and so far that you start getting scrambled messages. It's hard to keep up with exactly what's going on what side of town, and sometimes you create fear and panic in the wrong areas. And I think that's the advantage of the Nextdoor app, is it actually allows us to more effectively pinpoint communities and areas where we need to have that dialogue in an immediate fashion, particularly if there's something that's happened there, and we want to reach out to them and solicit that community or that group of communities around that event for any information about whether it be a robbery or an assault or a homicide or whatever the case may be. It's a good tool for us. We actually have a mapping system, and we can break it down by beats, by communities, and by streets. And at the same time, we can allow that wide open communication and dialogue back and forth between us and the members that are participating on this site.
So social media can be a good thing as far as communication between people and the police department, the sheriff's office, but you also mentioned that it can spread fear as well. It's a double-edged sword, it seems.
That is correct. And one thing I've learned since my involvement in Crime Stoppers is there is a nuance to dealing with media issues, and you cannot be too careful. If you release information in an inaccurate fashion, if you say more than you need to or not enough, that can have negative consequences. But again, you would much rather have that flow of information than none at all. And again, it'll never replace getting out, like the captain with Birmingham said, getting out and talking face-to-face with your neighbor.
Can I say something about Facebook really quick that
sure.
Take you off onto that?
Are you on Facebook?
Yeah, am I on Facebook? If anybody in here knows me, knows I'm on Facebook. So I'm a big social media person. And one thing that I wish we could touch and agree that we're going to leave in 2015 is posting fights on Facebook. And when I look at it, it actually makes me sick. I hate looking at Facebook fighting. Right? I think of it like porn. Right? You wouldn't people share Facebook fights, they post Facebook fights, they comment on them, but you wouldn't share porn, you wouldn't comment on porn, you wouldn't retweet that. And so I think we need to leave that in the past, and the more that we allow that in our space and in our energy, I think that it actually makes us more tolerant to these heinous things that we're seeing, and especially violence when it's young people doing things, because I think it incites more violence. I think of violence as like a community health issue, where the more that someone is affected by it, the more they can infect somebody else. So if we can touch and agree and leave Facebook fights and posts in 2015, I'd love that.
I'm curious from the rest of our panelists, what is something that you've observed that you think law enforcement should be doing differently?
I'd like to share something that I feel like Birmingham Police is doing, not something that they could do better, but something that they are doing. We have several beat officers that volunteer in our programs. So these beat officers during the day, I'm not sure at what point during the day, but I hope it's their lunch break or something like that. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But several beat officers volunteer in our schools, and they are doing the number one thing that I believe will prevent crime, and that's improving literacy rates in our school systems. We have Birmingham beat officers who are reading with our children every single day. So that is something fantastic that Birmingham police officers are doing. So I just wanted to share that. And if we want to prevent crime, let's talk about changing these illiteracy rates. Let's talk about moving the 18 failing schools in Birmingham City to zero. Let's talk about getting behind our superintendent, who is fantastic. And if you haven't met her, shake her hand and spend 5 minutes with her, and she will change schools in Birmingham City. But if we want to prevent crime, we have to replace the crime, and we need to replace crime with an education.
One thing that I'll admit we struggle with in law enforcement is sharing of information. Sometimes if it's information of a sensitive nature involving criminal activity, our Sheriff Mike Hale, 4 or 5 years ago now, I suppose, started an intelligence-led enforcement unit, and
one of the main things that we decided right away on that is that we would share of any information we had regarding crime activity with any other agency in our area that had a need to know. And that includes the 7-county area, metropolitan Birmingham. It's a different day and age. You know, things that happen in one community can't be shielded or kept from other communities, obviously through social media now that we have that. And same goes with law enforcement. We have to compare and share the information that we have because there's such mobility in the crime activity that's going on right now. People are coming from communities where there isn't much, and everything that there was has pretty much been taken and hit, to communities where there's a lot of stuff, and as Captain Prater said, it's easy pickings. So that's what we still have a way to go with that, and that includes working with the state agencies and the federal agencies collaboratively. And so that's our challenge.
And we're just now about out of time. I have one more question. This comes from WBHM's Facebook page, a listener question. A listener asks, what is the single greatest contribution that a citizen can make to help create a safe community? We'll end on a positive note. So can you each tell me one thing, speaking of that? The greatest contribution that an individual can make to making a safer community.
I bet you can guess what my answer is. Invest in our children. Invest in our children. Start early. Let's fix this illiteracy rate. Let's ignite a passion for knowledge and not crime.
I would say be more civil to each other in our everyday interactions. Show appreciation for each other and imagine that we can live, you know, in a peaceful city and imagine a day where we would have, you know, not have to have a forum about crime because this is something that happened so long ago because things have improved and each of us do our part to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves and our family members.
Get to know your neighbor and take care of your neighbor.
I would say if we get back to loving ourselves first, putting God first, loving other people, respecting other people, and not being afraid to help in the community, I think that would help us all.
Thank you all for being a part of this panel. I've been speaking with Carolyn Johnson Turner, the founder of Parents Against Violence Foundation, Sergeant John Pennington of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office and Crime Stoppers of Metro Alabama, Dr. Amy Aiken, the Executive Director of Better Basics, and Dr. Geraldine Agee from the Birmingham Violence Reduction Initiative. Thank you all very much for participating today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ails, Crime in the Greater Birmingham Area, on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. This program was recorded in front of a live audience at WorkPlay in Birmingham on Thursday, March 10th, 2016. Our engineer is Daryl McCalla. Our house managers were Audrey Atkins and Will Dahlberg. Thanks as well to Scott Hanley, Michael Crowell, Dan Carson, Esther Chamakili, and the rest of the WBHM staff and volunteers, and WorkPlay. Andrew Yeager moderated our first panel, and I'm Rachel Lindley. Thanks for listening.